All right, let's get started. Today, we're going to do a deep dive into a case that really shook things up when it comes to gun rights in America. We're talking about McDonald v. City of Chicago. Just imagine being 76 years old. You've had your home broken into multiple times, and then you're told you can't even own a handgun to protect yourself. Well, that was the reality for Otis McDonald.
You know what's really fascinating about this case? It's not just about guns. It's about this fundamental clash between individual rights and the power of the state. It really makes you think about that balance of power in our country.
It really does get to the heart of American federalism, doesn't it? We're talking about the Second Amendment,
yeah,
which, as we know, guarantees the right to bear arms. But the question this case raised is, does it apply equally to the states? Or can cities like Chicago just go ahead and make their own stricter gun control laws?
Huge questions.
Huge questions.
And these were the front and center issues in McDonald v. City of Chicago back in 2010. And for anyone listening who's working with Second Amendment litigation, I mean, this deep dive is absolutely crucial. This legal landscape around gun rights is always shifting. And McDonald is a landmark case that really changed the game for all of us.
So let's set the stage here. Who was Otis McDonald? And what was it that led him to challenge this Chicago handgun ban?
Well, Otis McDonald was a 76-year-old retiree. He lived in Chicago, and he had worked his whole life as a maintenance engineer. He even served in the Korean War. So he was no stranger to hardship.
Yeah.
To make things worse, he lived in a neighborhood that was just riddled with crime. He had already been the victim of several break-ins and was really worried about his safety.
Yeah, I can only imagine. He must have felt so vulnerable. So he wanted to own a handgun to protect himself, which seems completely reasonable considering what he was going through.
Absolutely reasonable. Right. You'd think so, wouldn't you? But at that time, Chicago had this incredibly strict handgun ban. It had been in place since 1982.
This wasn't just like a few restrictions. This ban basically made it almost impossible for people in Chicago to legally own a handgun.
It really did. It prohibited any new handgun registrations. And anyone who already owned a handgun had to register it with the city. So it was one of the toughest gun control measures in the entire country.
Wow.
So you can see how McDonald was in a really tough spot. He had this genuine need to protect himself, but he was legally blocked from owning the one thing that could help him do that.
It's this real conflict between an individual's right to self-protection and the city's efforts to try and control gun violence. But before we get into the nitty-gritty of McDonald, we need to rewind a little bit and talk about another landmark case. District of Columbia v. Heller.
Yes, Heller.
I feel like that one comes up a lot.
Oh, it does. It's crucial.
Yeah.
Heller really set the stage for McDonald because it was in that case in 2008 that the Supreme Court first affirmed that the Second Amendment actually protects an individual's right to own a gun for self-defense.
So Heller essentially said, yes, the Second Amendment protects individuals, not just militias.
You got it.
Okay, that's the core of it. But there's a catch. Heller only applied to federal enclaves like Washington, D.C. It didn't address whether that same individual right applied to states and cities.
Mm.
And that is where McDonald picks up the story.
Okay, so McDonald is all about whether the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms should be what they call incorporated against the states, meaning that states wouldn't be able to infringe on that, right?
Exactly. That's the crux of it.
Okay.
And this is where things get really interesting. Because to understand incorporation, we need to take a quick detour into constitutional law. There were two major clauses of the Constitution that were at the heart of this whole legal battle. The Due Process Clause and the Privileges or Immunities Clause.
Okay, constitutional law, always a fun ride. But in all seriousness, these clauses can be a bit tricky. So can you break them down for us in a way that even someone who hasn't been to law school can understand? Of course. So the Due Process Clause, which is part of the 14th Amendment, has been the traditional path for applying those Bill of Rights protections to the states. It's essentially a safeguard to make sure that states can't deny you those basic rights that you have as a U.S. citizen.
So it's like this big legal umbrella, protecting your fundamental rights, no matter where you live in the U.S.
You got it.
Okay. So McDonald's lawyers were basically arguing that, hey, the Second Amendment is one of those fundamental rights. And the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause says states can't mess with those rights. So Chicago's handgun ban is unconstitutional?
That's the gist of it.
Okay.
They were saying Chicago was taking away a right that's protected by the Constitution, and the 14th Amendment wouldn't allow that.
That makes sense. But you mentioned another clause, the Privileges or Immunities Clause. What's that all about?
Ah, yes. The Privileges or Immunities Clause. It's another part of the 14th Amendment. And it also deals with protecting citizens' rights. However, This clause has a very complicated history. It's been pretty much dormant since a case called the Slaughterhouse Cases. Back in 1873, it's one of those legal puzzles that even law professors scratch their heads over.
Oh, I remember trying to wrap my head around Slaughterhouse in law school. It was a head spinner, for sure.
It really is. But anyway, in McDonald, Justice Thomas, in his concurring opinion, really wanted to revive the Privileges or Immunities Clause. He saw it as a much more direct and historically accurate way to incorporate the Second Amendment.
So he's saying, let's dust this old clause off and use it to protect the right to bear arms.
Exactly. He believed it was the more textually sound approach, but the majority of the court didn't agree with him on that one. They stuck with the Due Process Clause. But Chicago, they weren't going down without a fight. Their defense really leaned on this idea of federalism.
You mean that states have the right to govern themselves and make their own laws?
Precisely. They argued that states should have the power to regulate guns however they see fit, to address their own public safety concerns. They were basically saying, leave gun control up to the states, not the federal government.
So it's this classic power struggle between states' rights and individual rights. Mm-hmm. So how did the court ultimately rule?
It was a close one, a 5-4 decision, which shows just how divided the court was on this issue. And
yeah,
the majority sided with McDonald.
5-4. That is close. So it sounds like this was a real nail biter. But what exactly did the majority say?
They ruled that the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms applies to the states. Through the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause, essentially they said that Chicago's handgun ban and any other state or local law that bans handguns completely is unconstitutional.
So a huge victory for gun rights advocates.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing the four dissenting justices weren't too happy about this outcome.
You're right about that. The dissenting opinions written by Justices Stevens and Breyer raised some serious concerns about the potential consequences of this decision. For example, Justice Stevens argued that gun rights aren't as deeply rooted in American history and tradition as other rights, like freedom of speech.
So he's saying that the right to own a gun isn't as fundamental as other rights we consider essential to American democracy.
Exactly. He believed that the 14th Amendment, which was ratified after the Civil War, wasn't really intended to be used to incorporate the Second Amendment.
So he's worried about opening a can of worms and maybe even undermining what the 14th Amendment was supposed to be about. What about Justice Breyer? What were his main concerns?
Well, Breyer's dissent focused more on the role of judges in a democracy. He argued that judges shouldn't be the ones deciding how to balance public safety with gun rights. He felt that these kinds of complex policy decisions should be left to legislatures, who are accountable to the people, and better equipped to weigh all the different factors involved.
So he's advocating for a more democratic approach to gun control, where elected officials make the rules, and not unelected judges. That's an interesting perspective. But obviously the majority didn't agree with that.
No, they didn't. Justice Alito, who wrote for the majority. He countered those arguments by really digging deep into American history and legal tradition. He cited things like Blackstone's commentaries, which emphasized the importance of self-defense as a natural right. And he highlighted concerns from the Reconstruction era about disarming freed slaves who needed to protect themselves.
So Alito's saying, look, the right to defend yourself with a gun has been a core part of American life from the very beginning. It's not some new idea.
Exactly. He argued that the right to armed self-defense is fundamental to what he called ordered liberty, a concept that's deeply embedded in American legal thinking. But, and this is important, Alito didn't say the Second Amendment right is absolute. He acknowledged that some gun regulations are totally fine.
So it's not like he's saying everyone can have whatever gun they want, no questions asked.
Not at all. He specifically mentioned things like prohibiting felons from possessing firearms or people with mental illness, and bans on carrying guns in sensitive places like schools or government buildings. He even used the phrase well-regulated in his opinion, which suggests that the Second Amendment doesn't completely rule out reasonable regulation.
That's a good point, especially for all our lawyer friends listening out there. It's so important to pay attention to those nuances and those limitations that are outlined in these court decisions. It's not always so black and white.
It really isn't.
So McDonald really didn't just settle this question of incorporation. It seems like it sparked a whole new wave of legal challenges and debates.
You're absolutely right. It did. For instance, it nullified those similar handgun bans across the country, like the one in D.C. that was at issue in Heller. But it also left a few big gray areas unresolved.
Okay, let's talk about those gray areas. What specific questions did McDonald leave unanswered?
Well, the biggest one is, what types of gun regulations are actually allowed after McDonald? The court said the Second Amendment applies to the states. but it didn't really draw a clear line on what specific restrictions go too far.
So we're talking about things like bans on assault weapons, waiting periods, red flag laws, magazine capacity limits, basically the whole world of gun control measures. It sounds like everything is suddenly up for debate.
You got it. That's exactly what happened. Lower courts have been flooded with cases challenging all sorts of gun laws, and they're still trying to figure out how to apply the McDonald precedent. There are all these conflicting rulings and disagreements. It's a real legal battleground out there.
I can imagine. So while McDonald affirmed this fundamental right to own a gun, it also created a whole new set of legal complexities.
Exactly.
And it's not just about those specifics of gun regulations. McDonald also reignited a debate about the very process of incorporating rights against the states. Remember Justice Thomas and his argument for using the Privileges or Immunities Clause?
Yes, of course.
That somewhat forgotten clause from the 14th Amendment. He seemed pretty passionate about bringing it back into the spotlight.
Oh, he was. And while he didn't win that one in McDonald, his arguments have been gaining some traction among legal scholars. They think that the court's reliance on the Due Process Clause for incorporation might actually be a historical error, and that the Privileges or Immunities Clause is a more accurate and historically sound approach.
So could this debate over how to incorporate rights have implications for other rights beyond just the Second Amendment? Could it impact other rights down the road?
It's definitely a possibility. The way the court approaches incorporation has big implications for the scope of individual rights and the balance of power between the federal government and the states.
We're getting into some deep constitutional waters here, but let's bring it back to practical matters for a moment. What are the key takeaways for McDonald for lawyers, especially those involved in Second Amendment litigation?
Well, one of the biggest takeaways is the importance of historical tradition. When challenging state gun laws, the majority opinion in McDonald put a lot of weight on whether a particular gun regulation has a basis in historical precedent, and this focus on history got even stronger in the 2022 Bruin decision.
So, lawyers need to hit the history books. What kind of historical arguments are we talking about here? Can you give us an example?
Sure. Let's say you're trying to challenge a modern-day ban on a specific type of firearm, like an AR-15. You need to do your research and see if similar restrictions existed in historical American law. If you can show a historical tradition of regulating that type of firearm, your argument is going to be much stronger.
So it's not enough to just say, this law violates the Second Amendment. You need to back it up with historical context.
Exactly.
And on the other side of that, lawmakers who are creating new gun control measures, they need to be really careful and try to avoid just outright bans on whole categories of firearms. So instead of saying no one can own an AR-15, they might need to take a more nuanced approach. Maybe focus on who can own certain firearms or where they can be carried.
Exactly. Restrictions tied to what they call sensitive places, like schools or government buildings, or regulations based on historical precedents, are more likely to hold up in court. It's all about finding that balance between respecting the Second Amendment and protecting public safety.
So McDonald wasn't just a legal victory for gun rights advocates. It was a huge shift in the whole legal landscape. That continues to shape how we deal with gun control in America.
It was a major shift. It really changed the balance of power in the gun control debate and left us with all these complex questions that courts and lawmakers are still trying to figure out today.
It really feels like those aftershocks are still being felt today. But before we wrap things up, I'd love to hear your final thought-provoking takeaway for our listeners. What's one thing they should really think about as they process all this information about McDonald?
You know, it's interesting to think about Justice Thomas and his focus on the Privileges or Immunities Clause. Even though it didn't really take center stage in McDonald, it could actually be a sign of a shift in how the court approaches incorporation in the future.
Yeah, you're right. We talked earlier about how Justice Thomas really wanted to use that clause, the Privileges or Immunities Clause, to incorporate the Second Amendment. But the majority went with the Due Process Clause instead.
Exactly. And even though his argument didn't win out in McDonald, it's really resonated with some legal scholars. They think that relying on the Due Process Clause for incorporation might actually be a historical mistake, and that the Privileges or Immunities Clause is a more accurate way to go, and more historically grounded, too.
So you're saying that McDonald, even though it was decided based on due process, might have accidentally given new life to this other clause, the Privileges or Immunities Clause, and that could have ripple effects for other rights down the line.
Precisely. It's like planting a seed, and that seed could grow into something much bigger. What if future cases start to move away from the Due Process Clause for incorporation? Could we see a comeback for the Privileges or Immunities Clause, not just for the Second Amendment, but for other rights as well.
Wow, that's a really big question. I bet our legal listeners are already thinking about what that could mean. Which rights could be affected? How would it change the balance of power between the federal government and the states?
It's definitely something to think about. McDonald v. City of Chicago was a landmark case, that's for sure. But it also left us with a lot more questions than answers. And that's part of what makes constitutional law so fascinating, you know? It's always evolving. It's this ongoing conversation, this constant search for how to define and protect our fundamental rights in a world that's always changing.
It's true. McDonald was like a legal earthquake. And it definitely reshaped how we think about gun rights in America. It affirmed this essential right to self-defense, but it also opened up all these new legal questions and challenges that we're still dealing with today.
And it's a powerful reminder that the law isn't set in stone. It's constantly being interpreted and reinterpreted as our world changes and our values change.
Well said. So to all our listeners out there, especially our friends in the legal field, stay curious. Stay engaged. Keep those legal minds sharp. This journey through the world of constitutional law is far from over.
And who knows? Maybe one of you listening will be the one to argue the next landmark case, the one that shapes our understanding of the Second Amendment and the very heart of American democracy.
That's all for our deep dive into McDonald v. City of Chicago. Until next time, keep exploring, keep learning, and keep asking those tough questions.